Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Grow connects you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights and weekends. There are no subscriptions, no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/try now today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/try now. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
What's going on, everybody? I hope you have been collecting what you love since the last time we had a podcast. And I hope you guys are doing great. And I hope your hobby and collecting journey has been rewarding, influential for not just for you, but for those around you. And you're getting to share that with somebody and not living under a rock or in a box. And you know, the thing about a hobby is it's meant to be shared. And today, the title of today's episode is called Down the Rabbit Hole. So I've been reading this book. It's called The Glory of Their Times. And a lot of people have been talking about this book. And this is what makes our hobby amazing. So I'm reading this book and I'm going through and I open it up and it's just, you know, first of all, there's all the vintage cards on the front, the gold bordered cards, but it's more than just a book about baseball cards because it's baseball stories written or provided through interviews with these old players when they were living. And man, this book is just amazing. So I want to talk about a couple things today, and the things that I want to talk about are, one, my journey down the rabbit hole. I guess you can refer to it as that, because I've never been a pre-war vintage collector, and now I'm reading this book and hearing the amazing stories. You know, I think what part of a vintage collector's cherish the most about the vintage cards, I mean, you know, we weren't alive in 1909 or 1917 to watch Babe Ruth win a World Series with the Red Sox and then go on to the Yankees and win a bunch there. But the difference is the game has evolved in such a way that we no longer have that personal connection to the ball players. These guys make so much money. They live incredible lives, and good for them. I'm more than happy for modern players with the contracts and stuff, but they don't have that everyday man aura about them, right? You're not going to find Mike Trout in the off season selling ice cream at an ice cream shop. But you will read about it in these pages of this book, how these guys did these things and they just seem to enjoy life, connect so much with their fans. That's why they were so beloved, because they had such great interaction off the field with their fans. And that's why people hated Ty Cobb, because he just had a disposition of that was just kind of nasty. People did not want to be around him because he was just kind of a grumpy old man, for so to speak. But it wasn't when he was old. It was his entire life. But some of these guys, they were beloved in their hometowns because of how they interacted with people. And one of the things I want to talk about is the way that we collect today in however we do our cards. And one of the things that I found for myself since I've put myself on a card budget, I'm noticing I'm buying fewer and fewer cards. I'm going to talk about a card that I purchased recently, but I really didn't take that out of my card budget because for me, it was, like in celebration of an accomplishment that I completed. But when you set a card budget, I don't know if anybody else has this issue, and that's why I want to put it out there to see. I don't know if it's really even an issue, but I'm buying less and less cards because I'm honing in, especially being more predominantly toward vintage, what I want to own. You know, I talked about curating a collection where when I'm dead and gone, because as I collect cards, if they go into my collection, now I do buy and sell cards, but if they go into my personal collection, those cards will never be sold. I don't anticipate them being sold while I'm alive. Maybe towards the end of my life, if I can anticipate that a little bit to help my wife and kids with getting rid of them. If they so choose, maybe they want to keep them. I don't know. Because I'm sure they mean much more to me than they do to any of them. But that's what I wanted to talk about today. So I'm in a world where I hunger for connection with other collectors. However, where I'm at, there's not a ton of people. I live in a town in Texas that has a population of 800 people. The biggest town near me is Abilene, and there's only 120,000 people there. And really, there's only one card shop, and it opened recently. Everything else has some cards with other things, but it's not a big thing where I currently live, where I live presently. And so I decided I'm going to give myself a card budget because there are cards that I would like to own that are four figures, right? Four figures, maybe even five figures. I haven't even gone down the road of everything I would like to have. That would be too much. It's one thing at a time, and maybe you have five things on your list, but the price on those cards could range from $500 up to $2,000 or $2,500. And now reading this book, I'm interested in pre-war cards, and I'm looking at a couple of long-term things I would like to do for my collection, like trying to collect. I'm going to go out and say it. I've been waiting to just kind of do an episode on it, and I will. I'm not going to do it today, but my long-term collection habit, I want it to be of players who hit 400 in their career. There's 36 of them, and I don't have the list in front of me, but I know there are some significant names on the list. Some of those guys played in the late 1800s, and it's going to be hard to acquire some of those cards. That's why I call it kind of a lifelong thing, because I think at the end of my life, unless something changes drastically for me financially, which I don't foresee because I love what I do. I'm a four-sport coach at a high school, and I coach high school and junior high sports, public school in the state of Texas. And because of that, some of these cards will probably never be attainable because of my financial situation with the amount of money I make. And it's just not, you know, I'm not going to spend $20,000 for a card. So I don't think that some of these cards will ever be in my collection, but I want to see as I progress through life, how many people from this collection, from this list of players that I can acquire and put into my collection. So I think that'll be fun for the back half or so of my life. You know, I'm in my 40s now, and it'll be a fun thing to do until I either pass away or I'm no longer in the frame of mind to curate that collection. or keep collecting it. So that's going to be my long-term card collecting goal is to acquire cards of players who hit 400 at some point in their career. And ideally, I would like to get playing day cards of those players. And I may eventually down the road accept post-playing day cards of those players just because they're going to be a lot easier to acquire or obtain, especially now as people's stories get told more and more. But so here I am collecting my money, my card money, my budget that I've set for myself. And the one thing I've noticed is I've pretty much saved up my card budget for like the last 4 months or 5 months. And now some of these four-figure cards are starting to come into play. And then I look and go, okay, well, when I go to my next show and I see Ash and I look in his cases and I find some of these cards that I want. Now I'm starting to think, okay, I might be able to get this one. But then in the back of my mind, I say, like I said, I've got cards that go from $500 upwards of four, maybe five figures. So the dilemma I'm having now, and I don't even have the opportunity to spend right now because there's nowhere for me to go to get the cards that I want unless I go to a card show or buy it online. And I don't want that. I want that transaction to be personal. So as much as I do buy cards online, there are certain transactions that I want to be personal transactions where I interact with the person who owns the card and we have a conversation about the card and then I purchase the card. I don't know if that's weird. Maybe you guys can agree with me on that. There are certain cards that I don't mind buying in the mail. You know, I'm a Washington Commander fan. I've been a Redskin fan since the 1980s. And Jaden Daniels is doing great right now. And Donruss just released their 2024 flagship cards. And so I bought two of his rookie cards online. Cool. I can transact small stuff like that on eBay, and that's okay. But when we're talking about 1952 Jackie Robinson, 1939 Playball Ted Williams, I don't want to buy that card on eBay. I don't want to buy that card online and have no personal dealings with the guy or the girl that I buy that card from. I want to interact with somebody when I make that purchase. I want to have that memory of I went here, I did this, and I bought this card. I crave it. And the thing that I'm finding now, though, is as my card budget increases because I keep saving it, now I don't want to spend it. Now I want to keep saving it because then it's like, well, if I save a little longer, then I can buy this card. If I save this many more months, then I can buy this card. And who knows, you know, I'm sure it's going to be the card that kind of speaks to me. I'm going to have a list of cards when I go to the Dallas Card Show the next time I go. And I'm going to have a list of cards that I want to acquire. And do I have to spend my whole budget while I'm there? No, but I'll have it to spend when I'm there. And the beauty of it, it's weird because you feel like sometimes that you're in the hobby, but you're not collecting because you're saving up your card budget to buy more expensive cards that you want to purchase. But at the same time, you're like, well, I'm this much closer to a bigger card or a more expensive card. And now, do I want to spend it on this or do I want to keep saving? So I'm sure it's going to have to be a pretty spur of the moment thing. But I want to know what you guys think about that, because is it just me who thinks that way? And it can't just be me. I can't be the first person to think like, oh, I've got a card budget. Now I'm saving it up. And the more I save up, the more proud of how I've saved it. And then I want to take it and maybe consider saving more for another big card and maybe starting at the top and working down could be a better option for me, where I find a card that I want the most and it's the most expensive card. And I go, you know what? I'm going to save till I get that card. And then I buy that one. And then the next one I know shouldn't be that much. It should be less. Maybe it'll be easier for me to do that and buy the bigger cards first and then move on to the smaller cards. I'm not sure. But now let's talk about something I did recently. So in reading Mr. Ritter's book, The Glory of Their Times, I'm not even all the way through, and the first guy in the book is Richard Marquardt. And I mean, I got hooked on this book when I was reading chapter one about Rube Marquardt simply because of his determination to play the game of baseball. And obviously he was talented, but I mean, I'm reading this book and it's talking about how he's 16 years old. His dad is a city engineer and the chief engineer in the city of Cleveland. And his dad didn't want him to have anything to do with baseball. So he had no support at home for what his passion was to play baseball, because in the turn of the century, baseball players were not looked up to like they are now. That's why they didn't make the money. That's why they worked regular jobs. And this guy at 16 years old, essentially ran away from home. He skipped out from home because he had such a strong desire to play baseball at a high competitive professional level and a belief in himself that he could do it if he set his mind to it. At 16, he leaves home, takes him 5 days to get to Iowa, where he plays in a game that day and wins. They don't pay him. So instead of just being happy to be playing, he didn't get paid to pitch that first game. So what does he do? Okay, well, I guess this team isn't the one for me then. And he starts making his way back home to Cleveland. I mean, when you look at when you compare generations of kids, and I have a 17-year-old son, I couldn't imagine him being so, he's undecided in what he wants to do. And I'm okay with that, but I could not imagine him, even at 17 years old, being so decisive on what he wants to do that he's willing to give up everything he has to go do it. But the generations were you could just tell how the generations are so different 100 years ago than they are today. I mean, now it's 125 years ago, 130, but these people at a young age were forced to mature and grow up because a lot of them didn't finish school. They didn't have the same standards as far as education and stuff goes. And watching this kid or reading about this kid who hopped on trains and hitchhiked his way to Iowa, took him 5 days to get there, pitched the game, wins, and then they tell him they're not going to pay him because the team that he pitched against was in last place. And for him to have the wisdom to be like, okay, these guys are just trying to use me, so I'm going back and I'll wait for a different opportunity. That is profound. And then he ends up back in Cleveland. He eventually does make it into the big leagues, plays with all these greats that we hear about today. And he has these personal connections with people where on his way back, he had kind of come across a fire station and it was cold in Chicago. And so he found himself in there. He fell asleep because he was tired. When the firemen got back, they gave him a hard time. They thought he was homeless, starting to run him out. And then he's explaining to them that he's a baseball player and he's going to make it to the big leagues one day. And when he does, every time they come to Chicago, he'll come and see them. And sure enough, the first time he was in the big leagues and they went to Chicago, the first place he went was down there to the fire station. And then he talked about how every time he went there, that was where he went. And he would go just sit down and talk with those guys and just give his time to those people, spending time with the people. And that determination at a young age, and maybe it kind of resonated with me because I grew up, I by no means did what he did. Obviously, I'm not a professional baseball player or potential Hall of Famer or anything like that. But I grew up poor, which he did not grow up poor. But I had this determination inside myself to not be what was, I did not want to become a statistic. And I didn't want to just be poor. And not, if I was going to be poor, it was because I was working in a job that I loved to do. It wasn't going to be because I lacked work ethic or determination or any of that. And I kind of sensed that with Rube Marquard's story. And at 17 years old, I left home and I never went back. And I consider myself in my early 40s a self-made man. You know, people did not help me get to where I was. It was almost a point of pride where if I didn't have something, I felt like I didn't need it or I didn't deserve it because I couldn't afford to have it. I wasn't going to take a handout from somebody. I wasn't going to let somebody give it to me. If I wanted it and I felt like I needed it that bad, then I needed to work for it. And then that way, when I did acquire it, it was, to me, a big accomplishment, right? I felt like I worked for that. And I think any person who has experienced that in their life, the difference between somebody giving you something and somebody and you working for something, you always appreciate what you work for more. And there's a life lesson in that, where when you work for it, you appreciate it more. You take care of it more because you know that it was that important for you to spend the money or the time that you had to do to acquire it. And that really resonated with me, his story. So recently, I wasn't always a coach. It's kind of been a lifelong passion. What I should say is I've kind of always been a coach. I've been coaching youth sports since I was 18 years old. It started off right out of high school, but I always was a volunteer. Little leagues, junior basketball leagues, baseball, football, basketball. I've always volunteer coached, given my time to do it. And in the meanwhile, when I got into my early 20s, I became a police officer. And that's how I provided for my family when they were prior to my son being born, and he's my oldest. And I always have prided myself on being able to take care of my family. And I feel like as a man, as a father, as a husband, that's my priority. And that's my responsibility. But I also felt really good about being able to provide and take care of my family. I felt like that's what I was supposed to do and that I was doing what I was supposed to do. But I always had a passion for kids, especially young boys who are going to become young men, because I never had that when I was a kid. And I wanted to make sure that if ever given the opportunity, I did what I could to help shape these young kids in sports into the young men that we want them to be in society. We don't want men running around having babies with a bunch of different women and not being fathers to those children. That's not good for us as a society. We want men to have a sense of responsibility, have a sense of ethics where, hey, I made this decision and now I'm going to take care of it, provide for it, all of these things. Even if they make a mistake, because I don't even know if you can call it, I mean, initially you can call it a mistake, but even if they get somebody pregnant at a young age, okay, what are you going to do about it? You're going to let that kid grow up without a father or without this, without, no, you need to own up to your decision, own up to your action, and go take care of that responsibility that you created upon yourself. And I think there's value in that for people and a society. And so that whole story of Marquard in chapter one, I was like, man, I know I've got these cards on my list. If I ever get a chance, I would like to see if I could find a card of his. So I start researching cards. And I find out that his cards are pretty reasonable. Within, $100, $200 bucks. Low grade T206s. And so I told myself, this is the first year that I'm coaching in the school district. And they wanted me to get a CDL, Class B CDL, so I could drive the buses for the athletes or field trips or whatever. I work in a small school district, so you have a title, but you wear many hats. So the more things you can do, the more useful you are. And, I kind of look at it as job security. Oh, we need somebody to do that? Yeah, I can do that. Oh, and the beauty of where I'm at in my life today is, do I need to be doing what I do? No. I retired from the law enforcement profession. I get a retirement from that, but I want to do what I'm doing. So I've been working really hard trying to balance teaching, coaching, home life, and then this additional thing that I've been trying to do while all those other things are going on. So I told myself, in the state of Texas, you have to take 5 written exams just to get your permit. Forget about the license, all that stuff. You have to pass 5 written exams at the DMV in order to just get a permit. And they're by no means easy, especially if you're looking at it from the perspective of only driving a school bus with kids to athletic events or anything like that. You have to know a lot about the whole thing to even just to be able to do that. So I told myself, when I pass the 5th exam and I get that permit, I'm going to celebrate by purchasing a card. And when I saw how reasonable Rube Marquard cards were, I said, man, that would be like the perfect way to celebrate getting my permit. So yesterday, I took my 5th test, I passed, I got my permit, and I did go on to eBay for this one, and I started looking, and I'm like, okay, what can I find? And well, the beauty of being in the hobby, but not necessarily always buying cards, I do like PSA. I like PSA slabs, but I also like SGC slabs. But the one thing I've learned from consuming other people's content is these T206, the smaller cards, any smaller card, not just the T206s, but in a PSA slab, they put a film, like a protective film, and its speculation is that it's to keep the card from moving around in the holder and keep it in place. But the thing is when they put the slab together, the film always wrinkles up around the edges, and it, to me, doesn't look very professional. Whereas when you look at SGC and it's that black and white tuxedo look, oh my goodness, those cards look beautiful in those slabs. And even though there's no registration or anything like that for, there's no set registries on SGC, not right now, currently anyway, I was like, man, if I'm buying T206, I'm not buying PSA. Just not doing it, because I don't want it to look, I don't want the presentation to look cheap. So I decided pretty quickly that I'm not going to buy a PSA slab of a T206 Rube Marquard, and I happened to find an SGC2 for $205 with free shipping. So yesterday, after passing that test, I find this card, and remember, I have criteria. I did fudge my criteria a little bit because centering is important to me, but one thing that bothers me is if the card is off center, left to right, not so much top to bottom. And it's a little heavy on the top, or a little thin on the top, a little heavy on the bottom. But left to right centering, the card is amazing. And everything else was beautiful about the card. And I said, this is, after reading about this guy, I feel like I have this personal connection, even though this was from 100-something years ago. I really want to make this my first pre-war card purchase. And that's what I did. I purchased the card. I'm waiting for it to come right now. Hopefully everything goes well with that. And I am super excited to get my first pre-war card. And it just so happens to be Rube Marquard. And if you know the book, I bought the T206 portrait. So there is a black and white picture of the card inside the book. So if you're wondering about which card I purchased, it's that one. The one that's black and white, the T206 portrait card of him from the book. So that was my first pre-war purchase. I'm excited to share it with you guys. Let me know what you guys think. I know I kind of went off. That's why the episode is going to be titled Down the Rabbit Hole, because I know I went off on a couple tangents, but the two main things I wanted to talk about were some pre-war collecting, the connection that we have, or we can make to those people, because they were just kind of salt of the earth guys and they had to work just like everybody else, but they happened to play baseball too. And also, what do you guys do with your card budget? I want to know. Send me an email, oldschoolcards24@gmail.com. I will respond. You send me an email and I will respond. Let me know. What do you do with your card budget? Do you have a card budget? Do you feel that way too, where if you're saving up money on your card budget, or do you say, I want this card, and then you set a budget where you save for that? I don't know. For me, this is something I've been doing for almost the last, I would say, 6 months to a year, where it's a good way for me to really decide what I want to spend my money on as far as a card goes. And two, it forces me to put that money aside where I can potentially make larger card purchases because I've been saving for so long. Because being married as long as I have, you know, I'm not going to go to a card show and spend $5,000 out of my bank account on a card like that. I don't think that would be fair to my wife to just be like, oh, by the way, I spent $5,000 at the card show today out of the account. I kind of feel like that's a little bit selfish. But if I, let's say I wanted a $5,000 card and I saved $400 a month until I had that money to go buy the card, then I don't think that's very, I think that's being smart about it. At the end of the day, you still get the $5,000 card. But one way going about it is a much more mature way, I think, to do it. And another way to go about it is could potentially cause arguments or whatever. And, you know, me and my wife have been married for almost 20 years, and I just wouldn't want to do that to her. I could say this: if my wife went somewhere and said, oh, I did this, I spent $5,000, I might be a little taken aback, but would it really matter to me? No. It really wouldn't. If it was something she needed or she thought she needed or whatever, I would be completely okay with it. As long as it wasn't something that was like a regular occurrence and didn't leave us money that we couldn't pay the bills or something. But that's why I'm doing the card budget, because I don't want it to seem like it impacts my finances. So if every month I take a certain portion out, I put that aside, then that doesn't affect bills or anything else. And the beauty of it is it's almost a separate little savings, because if something were to happen, you know, I would not be selfish and be like, well, that's my card money, we're not touching that. No, if I need the money to do something in real life, like pay for a medical bill or something, like, of course, that's where that money goes, because you have to prioritize your family over everything else. That's why it's a hobby. You can't marry your cards. So yeah, of course I would defer my card budget into emergency funds if I needed to, but it's essentially like another way of saving money until I decide there's something I want to purchase. And the beauty of buying vintage cards is, if I paid $2,000 for a card, 6 months from now, even if the card goes down, maybe it's an $1,800 card, for the most part, the money is safe in that card if you're investing it right. And you're not really following cycles and stuff like that. But for me, it's a long-term investment because I don't anticipate selling these cards like the Richard Marquard, the Rube Marquard card. Not doing it, not selling it unless I had to. Would I sell it if I had to do something? Of course I would. But I want that to be something that my wife and my kids sell so they can have something later. So let me know what you guys think. oldschoolcards24@gmail.com. Thank you for joining me for this next episode of Old School Cards. I'm having a blast doing it as I'm sitting here looking at the football field, getting ready to play a Friday night football game in the state of Texas. Love to hear from you guys. Reach out. If you got questions, feel free to ask the questions. I'll answer them on the podcast. Let's interact, guys. Until next time, guys, keep collecting what you love. Old School Cards, out.